The following podcast is a production of Institutional Real Estate Incorporated. For the most comprehensive industry news and information, visit our website at irei.com and sign up for our free daily news alerts.
Before we get started, Grubb is a very famous name in real estate, as in Grubb and Ellis from the days of yore. Are you, do you have a blood interest in fortune associated with the family, Clay?
I don't. I'm friends with the Ellis kid, and he always says if we ever start a company, he wants his name first.
Ellis and Grubb.
No, they came out of San Francisco in the 60s and 70s, and we're from small town North Carolina, and it was helpful when we would go out to Colorado and try to get dinner reservations, and they'd be like, "Oh, you're in the real estate business." We'd be like, "Yes." And we realized they were thinking about the other Grubbs instead of us, but that's okay.
So Lexington, as soon as I saw Lexington, I thought you're in Kentucky. Then I saw North Carolina, and, you know, I lived in North Carolina for about 5 years in Charlotte, and I don't remember a Lexington, North Carolina. Where is it in the state?
But barbecue capital of the world. It's only 1 hour north of Charlotte on I-85. So just
1 hour north
on your way to Greensboro.
Wow. Okay. Then I've probably driven right through it without even realizing it was. It's been a while, but barbecue capital of the world. So there's different styles of barbecue, Clay. What is the right or your favorite style, or what is the Lexington style?
Well, there's only one barbecue capital of the world.
But what's the right style of barbecue? Yeah. I understand some can be vinegary.
Ours is ketchup based. Eastern North Carolina is vinegar-based and South Carolina is mustard-based. And so Lexington's big claim to fame is the fact that we're really the reason the Cold War ended. Reagan had the summit with Gorbachev in Williamsburg, and they served Lexington barbecue. And lo and behold, the Cold War ended as part of that.
There you go. There you go. If it hadn't been for the right food...
Barbecue is enough for me.
I hope Lexington is exporting many tons of barbecue these days to Moscow and Leningrad and St. Petersburg and such.
Yes, and we need to probably start shipping to China and elsewhere too. So we'll work on that.
So here we go. Welcome to the program. I'm your host, Mike Consul, and joining me by phone is Clay Grubb, Chairman and CEO of Grubb Properties. Grubb Properties is a private equity real estate fund manager with an integrated subsidiary specializing in multifamily residential housing and commercial office properties. The firm is based in Charlotte, North Carolina, but Mr. Grubb himself hails from Lexington, North Carolina. And Clay Grubb, to the point of this discussion, is author of Creating the Urban Dream, subtitled Tackling the Affordable Housing Crisis with Compassion, published this year by Forbes Books. Clay Grubb, welcome to Author Spotlight.
Thank you, Mike. I appreciate you having me.
Let's talk about your characterization that... Yeah, because your book says we're on the brink of a crisis. And I'd like you to characterize the nature of that crisis. Actually, even before you do that, Clay, I would like you to say, how did you get involved in affordable housing at all? Because when I was introducing your company, it doesn't say anything about affordable housing. Are you actually involved in affordable housing, or how did this come to your attention to such a degree that you wrote about it?
Well, I think at the end of the day, it's the word affordable housing is kind of a loaded word with lots of connotations. And, there's what I'd call capital A affordable housing, which is defined, as very rigidly, federal tax credits, 30-60% median income restrictions, lots of red tape. We do not do that type of affordable housing. We do what I'll call little a affordable housing, which is market rate driven housing that is affordable, or value-based housing. And my dad actually started this company with that very strategy. And he was primarily a home builder in red line neighborhoods. And back then, the banks would discriminate primarily against African Americans. And so he would finance those homes at whatever the advertised rate was at the bank. And so basically we had a not-for-profit finance division that financed hundreds of homes for families who would otherwise been cut out of the American dream. And my joke always is the way he's able to justify a not-for-profit finance division was he broke all the child labor laws. And so at age 12, yours truly collected mortgages and did amortization schedules by hand. And that's where I really learned a lot about compassion. And, you know, when that factory employee couldn't go to work because they broke their leg or whatever may be happening, you knew they couldn't make their home payment. And so we would work with them. And we've continued that kind of spirit of compassion. And so today, under our Link Apartments format, we build just 6 floor plans, 2 of which folks making as little as 60% of median income can get into. So we really focus on bringing a value-based urban product to the cities in which we operate.
So your father, what was his experience in terms of the banks redlined because they didn't want to deal with the African-American community. They thought they were a bad risk, apparently. Your father saw an opportunity there, and this did work out for him, I'm assuming, that the African-American was not a bad risk. As long as you're working within their means, they paid their mortgages and they became homeowners. Is that the case?
That is. Out of the 400... approximately 400 mortgages we did, I think we foreclosed on 6, which is an amazing track record given that, you know, these are folks that all couldn't get loans from lending institutions. And, you know, I mean, one of the stories that my assistant loved to tell was, you know, she walked into my office and said, "Hey, Ellison McIntosh is coming to see you." And this was when I was in Charlotte, and I'm like, "Wow, that's a name from the past." And, oh my gosh, I only remember talking to Ellison whenever he was in trouble and, you know, would need, you know, some relief for his mortgage payment. And so I had no idea why he was driving all the way to Charlotte. And I then walked in the conference room, and he sat there with 2 of his kids and 3 of his grandkids. And little did I know, he had his 360th mortgage payment with him and then owned his house outright after that meeting, and which was, you know, it's really impactful to see. And so it made a lot of difference in the trajectory of a lot of families' lives. And that was meaningful and something we try to continue to maintain in the spirit of our company.
So as I told you, I lived in North Carolina, and there's nothing bigger in North Carolina, certainly not in Charlotte anyway, where your company is based, than the churches. So was your dad a man of faith? Is that part of what drove him to actually reach out to a community that was being ignored in this way?
You know, I think he became one, certainly, and that was more driven by my mother. But, you know, I think he just felt like it was a good business opportunity. But he believed in doing the right thing. And his sister was very involved, so it was really the two of them. And she actually continued the work long after we got out of that business as a for-profit enterprise, and then continued to work for the CDC in Salisbury, where she was heavily involved in helping people maintain their homes after all the big Pilatex plant closed and other issues. So I think at the end of the day, housing and trying to change people's lives and improve their lives has been a meaningful part. You know, it's interesting. I mean, even today, we have a very unique program at Grub Properties, and if you live in one of our apartments for more than 5 years, we cap your rent at the CPI index for the remainder of your life. And that's a program that we do voluntarily. We have close to 400 families on that program, and many of them who would get pushed out of their apartments today if we didn't have that program. And that's something that, you know, I don't think is necessarily driven by any religious belief, but it's actually something we think is really good business. And and our properties that have those long-term residents are safer. They're more like communities. One of our properties is in a difficult neighborhood, and I'll tell you, we're known as the safe haven in that neighborhood, and I kind of call it the grandmother effect, where you've got the grandmothers at home in the day and still living there, and the example I use, somebody fires up a joint in the parking lot, within 30 seconds somebody's hollering out the door at them, and 60 seconds somebody's called the police, and 90 seconds the third one's got him by the ear and dragging him across the parking lot.
And policing, yeah.
And that particular property has over 90 families on this program, 30% of the property, and last year it was one of our highest grossing net revenue increases in our portfolio, and that's because people would pay a premium to live there because they realized the stability that comes from having those long-term residents.
Well, and that's being able to retain residents is a big deal. And I love that, the sound of that program, 5 years and then your rent's tied to the CPI and no hires. So yeah, retention's a big deal, having to go out and find new people and not knowing the nature of the people you're bringing in. As hard as I'm sure that you try to make sure that you vet people and so on. So let's get back to my original question, which I have since digressed from. Your book says that we're on the brink of a crisis. Characterize the nature of, you're talking about the affordable housing crisis. Characterize the nature of that affordable housing crisis.
I can characterize it pre-COVID. You know, currently the crisis has been exacerbated, tenfold. But, coming into COVID, 40% of Americans could not afford the average price of a new apartment in America. 80% of Americans could not afford the average price of a new home in America. And you have what I believe is over 20 million residents paying over 50% of their income in rent. And that's not a sustainable future for America.
So talk about how we got to this state of affairs. The housing market in the United States used to be affordable. And it's true that there's areas all over the United States out in the hinterlands where the housing probably is affordable. But when it comes to urban centers, job centers, it has really migrated into this unaffordable status. So what has happened within the housing market in the United States that got us to this point? Do you have some insights about that?
Yeah, I mean, one comment, though, as you pointed out, I'll say is housing affordability is actually the easiest thing for any community to fix. All they have to do is make their community undesirable to live in, and it'll be very affordable. But the reality is the jobs and the opportunities are in the urban areas. And these young folks want to live in the urban areas. And now even the boomers who are empty nesters want to live in the urban areas. And so that's where the amenities are. That's where the opportunity is. And it's much more expensive to build in these urban areas. We've also, it was a real, I don't know, crime may be too strong of a word, but, there was a lot of abuse that led to the 2008-2009 global financial crisis. But what happens is this government always overswings. As the pendulum swings, we overreact. And so at a point when homes coming out of 2008-2009 were the most affordable they've been in years, we crackdown and basically would not provide mortgages to the hardworking and deserving families that could have gotten them. And so as a result, the only people that could buy all these distressed homes were the Wall Street private equity folks. And so they're the ones that bought up all the single family homes as opposed to, you know, the working class American. And those homes have now gone up, you know, 3x in value, which has been great for, you know, bonuses and other things in the private equity world, but it certainly hasn't done anything for Main Street and the economic mobility and the divide we have between the rich and the poor. And so that's continuing to get exacerbated. So until we figure out financial programs to get families into homes where they can participate in the American dream, in the prosperity, it's going to continue to be a problem. Now, the apartment sector is working hard to try to fill that gap, but the reality is 75% of the apartments built today are primarily designed for the folks making 140% of median income and over. And the reality is that's where the margins are. And then the other 25% is the true, what I called capital A affordable, which is truly subsidized. And so middle America, the young folks with the jobs, the policemen, the teachers, the hospital employee, they're really getting left out of even the apartment boom that's going on today. And so it's sad. You know, and I think one of the things that we do at Grub Properties is really focus in on what are those levers we can pull to make this apartment community a safe, nice place to live, but as affordable as we possibly can.
Now, you have, given some insight into this next question, but I do want to ask, what do you see as our country's path out of the housing crisis? Because it seems to be a really sticky problem. It's not like it's being solved in any significant way. How do we move from where we are today to where we need to be?
Well, you know, there's no silver bullet. It's going to take a lot of hard work. But I think first and foremost, we need to realize that, you know, when the financial crisis happened in 2008-09, the homes that were foreclosed on had nothing to do with the amount of equity in the value of those homes. It had everything to do with the liquidity of the homeowner that lived in it. And J.P. Morgan has a great report called Trading Equity for Liquidity. And the reality is if you had $100,000 of equity in your home or you were underwater $100,000 in the value of your home, if you had the ability to make your mortgage payment, you paid it. If you didn't have the ability because you had lost your job and you had no source of income, you didn't pay it. And it had almost zero to do with whether you had equity or not. If you had the ability to make your home payment, you made it. And so I've been working with a number of folks to come up with down payment assistance loan programs that then convert into emergency lines of credit. And so this is one of my little pet projects that I'm working on, which is part of what inspired the book, is the idea that, you know, you can get into a home with income, but you maybe haven't been able to save up for that down payment, which is very hard to do in today's world, when, especially with student debt and other obligations. And that down payment assistance program, you pay at a faster amortization than you would a typical mortgage, and maybe that's 7 or 10% of the value of your home. But then you go to the hospital. COVID hits, you know, whatever the next disaster is or event that happens in your life, you have access to draw back on that original down payment assistance program to make sure that your mortgage payment stays current. And so That's one way that I think, and especially today with these historically low interest rates, if we can get folks in, you know, a home mortgage today is about 40% cheaper per month than the rent of an apartment. So I think if we can get families into homes, that would do a significant, that'd be a significant step in the right direction for many of those families. The other thing is, I mean, I think we need to continue to educate the financial, world that, hey, apartments are extremely safe bet. Housing of any type is extremely safe bet, you know, shortage of, you know, maybe the, you know, $10 million condos in New York City. But the reality is housing for middle America is about as secure and safe of an investment as you can make these days.
Interesting. So let me ask you this then, because I was listening to a program where one person said, if the result of the COVID, the coronavirus pandemic is that all these people are working from home has made employers think, look, we don't need all this office space. We can start cutting down on office space. That's a property type that you're into as well. And we are to, and now this is obviously speculation, but if suddenly there is a lot more office space available, but not occupied, the opportunity then would be to turn that structure into affordable housing. Is that realistic at all? You're in an urban area yourself, although Charlotte's a boom town. You've got it's a banking capital. It's got tremendous wealth and whatnot, but not all cities are that way. What about office buildings being repurposed as affordable housing? If that was to be the case, that the amount of the demand for office space was to shrink significantly, does that make any sense to you?
Well, I mean, certainly there are going to be buildings that are converted to multifamily. I live in an office building that has been converted into multifamily. As I mentioned, I live, you know, right on the square in downtown Charlotte. But, you know, it is, you know, middle America is not living in my building. It's Michael Jordan and Cam Newton and, you know, a few other people like that. It's not inexpensive to convert these buildings to housing. But also the reality is we're creating almost 1 million households a year. And we're creating a fraction of that in housing. So, I think that would be wonderful, to convert some of these office buildings to multifamily, and that would help. But I think that's a small percentage of what we'll need. Because, you know, the reality is, you know, we now have more 29-year-olds than ever in the history of the United States. But we actually have more 13-year-olds than we have 29-year-olds. So this massive millennial population that's coming through right now, the reality is there's about a whole nother 10 years of peak births that is yet to come through the pipeline and start creating households. And so this demand is not going to go away in the next decade.
So what kind of innovation do you see being pursued by various cities or investors with regard to affordable housing? I mean, sometimes it's city policies, and then it's the investors or development companies, real estate companies like yours that could come up with these ideas. You've already talked about some ideas, but are there some others you would point to that you've seen around the country?
Yeah, I mean, I think the biggest advantage we have is that we are in the office business. And therefore, we see opportunities that many of our brethren in the multifamily business may see, but don't know exactly how to get to. And that is the reality is we look at our office division the way a steel mill may look at its mines. You know, it's where your core commodity comes from. And so one of the biggest drivers that we source is office buildings that come with large surface parking lots. And the reality is that surface parking lot is an environmental hazard. The asphalt absorbs lots of heat, creates lots of stormwater runoff. It creates dead space for potential crime. And so we go in and work with the municipalities to try to get entitlement. And then we will take that parking lot, put a brand new parking deck up next to the office building, and then wrap that parking deck with multifamily. And the beauty is if a 100,000-foot office building needs 350-space parking deck and a 280-unit apartment community needs a 350-space parking deck, well, standalone, we'd be building 700 parking spaces. Well, when we combine them, the office user's a daytime parker, the multifamily is primarily a nighttime parker, and so we can reduce that count down to 480 parking spaces and still have, 130 swing parking spaces for the guy who works late or the person who sleeps in late or maybe working from home. And so that's about a $5 to $7 million subsidy just in the parking. But we've also gotten probably a $5 to $7 million subsidy in the price of the land because it came free with our office building. And then we're putting people right next to where they work. And then they don't have to even own a car. And the reality is according to AAA, is the average American spends $9,000 a year on their car. And that's just, something that is very expensive and a huge barrier to the affordability housing index. I did an op-ed in the Charlotte Observer where I was like, look, if I build a 300-unit apartment community in downtown Charlotte, it costs me $75 million if I have to park it. If I don't have to build any parking, I can build that same 300-unit apartment community for $60 million, and I can actually use less land, so I can have more green space or potentially even have more homes on that same site. And that $15 million swing results in about $250 a month in rent that somebody would have to pay or would no longer have to pay to live in that same apartment community. And so parking is a big component and a big barrier. And so, the way I look at the future is young folks today, historically you would get an education, get a car, and you get an apartment. And that's no longer going to be the option going forward. They're going to have to pick two of the three. And so, they may get an education and get a car and live at home with mom and dad. And we have a record amounts of those doing, more doing that than any time since the Great Depression. And that was before COVID. And I think there's probably over 30 million 20-year-olds living with mom and dad today. But many, and some may opt not to get an education so they can have a car or an apartment. But many will get that education and prefer to have an apartment as opposed to having a car. And so therefore they need to live near where they work or live on transit or live on a greenway. So also biking is a big proponent. Everything we do is centered around trying to promote folks to get on bikes and try to build mobility that way without car ownership as well.
I know that Charlotte's a pro-development city, so the city's probably works with you in a really positive way. But if you look across the country, that's not always the case. How much blame for the affordable housing crisis in our country resides with local governments in local government policies versus the private sector? And I say the private sector because I think most people who decide I'd like to get into development, real estate development, they don't necessarily think of affordable housing as having the greatest sex appeal in the development industry. So what about that? Where does some of the blame lie here? And in what proportions? I don't expect you to be specific, Clay, but you know, the what are right. you seeing?
Well, I think that it's really interesting. Every municipality has blame. Some are significantly worse than others. And some are starting to recognize it. You know, it's interesting. We do business in Chapel Hill, and I pick on Chapel Hill a lot, though, you know, they're doing a lot of great things. But they are a community that is very committed to the affordability of housing, but yet they fight tooth and nail every developer. And so the reality is this the least affordable community in the state? And it's interesting, if you go around the country, liberal jurisdictions tend to be less affordable than conservative jurisdictions. And that's because they tend to fight the private sector more, making it harder, and therefore they get less supply. And the reality is it's just a, you know, I'm a big believer in, you know, economics 101, which is supply and demand. I kind of view that, you know, that's a law of nature, just like gravity is. You know, if you have more demand than you have supply, it's going to be more expensive. If you have more supply than you have demand, the price is going to drop. But you know, what's refreshing, and I have in my book, I do a shout out to Derwin Montgomery, who is the youngest city council member in Winston-Salem. And he is probably one of the most liberal and vocal advocates for affordability and the disenfranchised. He runs the Bethlehem Homeless Shelter in Winston-Salem. Yet he is always the first person to pick up the call and asks Clay, what can I do to make your project more profitable? What can I do to help you build it faster? Because he understands that the faster I can build, the cheaper it will be and the more affordable I can make it. And that is very unusual. I mean, I would argue that the fire chief in America probably is the biggest obstacle to affordability in any municipality. The building inspections departments are significant barriers to affordability. And we're dealing this right now. Atlanta, the mayor's come out and said, very committed to affordable housing. They're actually starting to impose affordable set-asides. But at the same time, they have eliminated as a policy the phasing of any new projects. And so therefore, it's going to result in me delivering an apartment community that's under construction 4 months later than it otherwise would. And the reality is once you're about $50 million into a project, the carrying cost is about $10,000 a day. So she adds 120 days to my project, she's added $1.2 million in cost.
Wow.
Well, there's nothing about that that makes it affordable. And so that's definitely, and the NIMBYism is obviously the obviously big one. You know, we bump into towns all the time that, you know, are like, hey, we're rich white folks and we don't want anybody coming in our town if they're not rich white folks. And, you know, and that's certainly very frustrating as well.
So, you know, you have a section in your book called, titled A Tale of Three Cities. Tell our listeners about the three cities you picked and why and what they illustrate.
Well, I think at the end of the day, it was really frustrating to write that chapter. I'd say that was the most frustrating chapter in my book because, you know, you want to shine a bright light where folks are doing it really well. But it was really hard to find a municipality that was doing it well. You know, we focused on Nashville, Denver, and Seattle. And I would say, you know, a lot of it has to do with the fact that they're stepping up and really trying innovative new things. And so I think really our focus was more about, hey, here are municipalities that are thinking out of the box. And you need to think outside the box to achieve our challenges. And I can, you know, I have a fair amount in my book on national policy as well. And I think those are probably better examples of the challenges we see, because, you know, I'd like to say that there's a municipality that is doing it right, but they all have significant challenges. And the political will to actually help the developer achieve the end result is thin. It's hard to find.
Well, what are the three cities, and which one is the model, is a positive model?
I'd say let's just skip that question.
Buy the book, ladies and gentlemen. We don't want to get Clay, the frustration is in your voice, so we'll move on. But there are cities in this country that are doing it right. Would you agree with that, or is there really, do you really not see a city that is where it really needs to be in terms of creating and maintaining a real base of affordable housing?
You know, I think Seattle is probably the example that stands out as somebody that's reacting the most. But, you know, they did so much to exacerbate the problem there that they have no choice. But Seattle is definitely a community that's doing a lot of innovative things today. And we look to them and what they're doing and, you know, and their involvement both with the private sector. You know, and a lot of municipalities are really, you know, jumping on the accessible dwelling unit where you can have the, you know, apartment above your garage. You know, a lot of municipalities are starting to get rid of, you know, the setbacks that create odd lots and small lots and allowing those to be buildable. But, you know, it's interesting. I mean, as pro-development as Charlotte is, we're actually trying to build a project on the Greenway, walkable to downtown, without parking. And the neighbors are going, you know, ballistic, and they've got a petition to oppose it. And, you know, because they, you know, they...
The NIMBYism again, right?
Backyard.
Yeah, exactly. They're not in my backyard. Yeah. So, you know, Clay, obviously there's vast, I alluded to this earlier, there's vast areas of the United States where housing is affordable. And we have been going through this technological revolution where we have the means of production. If you're a knowledge worker, you have the means of production in your pocket, you know, in your briefcase, laptops and desktops and smartphones and what have you. And now that we've had this coronavirus pandemic, I think it's underscoring that people can be quite productive, maybe even more productive working remotely. So one would kind of intuit that a person, say, living in Charlotte, who decides Charlotte's pretty expensive and I can do my work anywhere, why not move to Florence, South Carolina, or to Fayetteville, North Carolina, where I can afford a nice home can get my work done just as well from there. All I need is permission from my employer. I think that's happening more and more, just in terms of employers being comfortable with people working remotely. Obviously, that's not the case for all types of employment, because we do still have manufacturing in this country and meat processing plants and what have you. But do you think that that trend, hopefully it's a trend, is going to allow for a greater dispersion of the population and take some of the pressure off of the urban areas with regard to, and once that pressure is alleviated, you getting back to economics 101, supply and demand, the cost of housing starts to come down at least a little bit.
You know, I mean, it's an interesting concept. But the reality is you know, we thought we'd see that with the desktop, then we thought we would see that with the laptop, then we thought we would see that with the cell phone, and now we think that, hey, maybe the virus will generate it. And the reality is you know, working, not having to work in the office will get more flexible. But arguably, it's the most flexible it's ever been in history pre-COVID. And yes, that's a trend that's been around for at least the last decade or so. But the reality is people crave interaction with people.
True.
And
human nature.
So it is, it seems like this acceleration of urbanization across the world may pause, but I don't see it slowing down in any way, shape, or form. I mean, people want to have, they don't want to, you know, they want to be able to walk to Whole Foods and Starbucks, and, you know, you're not going to be able to do that in Fayetteville. And they're going to want to go to the bars, and they're going to want to see live music, and, you know, they're going to want to go to plays, and they're going to crave the interactions that come with being in urban areas. And the cultural opportunities are significantly richer in these urban areas. And as people have more free time, they pursue those things more. And as a result, that, I think, just reinforces the urbanization.
Now, you say at the start of the book that you had dreamed for decades about writing a book, but housing was not the topic. So tell us what type of book you were hoping to write before the idea for this one grabbed a hold of you.
My kids have some of the most colorful ancestors that probably have ever lived. And between my wife's family and my family, and I had all these, you know, incredible stories of my grandparents, and literally the New York Times would write about them, comparing the Hatfield and McCoys had nothing on the Grubb and the Davises and their disputes in Churchland, North Carolina. And then I met my wife, and I was like, oh my God, all your folks, all of these crazy folks that I had read about in history are all still living in your family and your life. And so between those two, there's a very colorful history that would also, I think, be quite comical. But it starts with my great-grandfather, who built one of the first steel and concrete high-rises in North Carolina back in 1909. Who was then murdered in his sleep before he finished the building. And his wife confessed to the murder, though we are 100% certain that she didn't do the murder. And so there's a very colorful history there.
So she was probably protecting another family member by trying to take the rap on that, it sounds like. Well, what did they fight about, the Grubbs and the Davises? What was the sticking point? Was there some central issue? Was it property? Was it natural resources? What was the battle line about?
So my great-grandfather was Clay Grubb, and he made his fortune in the whiskey distilling business. And one Sunday, he shot his brother-in-law, Obie Davis, in church and killed him. And so I don't know if that was the start of the feud, but that was certainly the tipping point.
I get it. So it was revenge. I mean, it was a killing, then there's the revenge, and then there's revenge for the revenge. And yeah, we see that a lot around the world, Clay. So there's still time to write that book. It sounds like it would be a really interesting read. So, but in the end, or not in the end, when you finally did sit down and start writing, you decided affordable housing. So what prompted you to decide, this is something I want to write now or need to write now? Why affordable housing?
Well, I think you hit the nail on the head. It was something that needed to be written now. It's a call to action now. And there are a lot of things that we can do to change the trajectories of people's lives. And Charlotte's a great example. I mean, Harvard did a study of the 50 top cities and their economic mobility. And for Charlotte, the resident that was in the bottom 20% that was born in Charlotte, we were 50 out of 50 in providing economic mobility for that resident to move up in the world. And we just, it's not going to be a great place for our children if there's a real divide between, the rich and poor. And, we're seeing right now with the protests between white and black and, even internationally between China and the U.S. Those types of things are very, very scary and very damaging. And a lot of it is driven by, economic opportunity.
So what city in that Harvard study was number one for mobility?
Yeah, I don't know. That's a great question.
So Charlotte failed the test. Okay, yeah, they failed the test.
Charlotte was dead last. I probably could have answered a couple of years ago who was number one, but I don't remember at this juncture.
I can always look that up. Our listeners can always look that up. It's the miracle of Google allows us to answer all these questions.
I probably could have Googled it while we were sitting here. But
Well, let me ask you this. The readers, our listeners who are going to be buying your book, what are the big takeaways that you expect readers to come away with after they've read your book? What maybe just highlight what the big or overarching points that you would expect a reader to come away with?
Well, I think the number one point that I think I try to drive home, but I probably do it less directly than I should, is that government is not the answer. And us thinking government is going to fix our housing problem is, basically like my expectations that government was going to take care of me when I got COVID. And, I lived the whole coronavirus thing in January with my daughter not being able to go back to college because she goes to NYU Shanghai. And only to then get the virus myself on March 4th and find out we don't even have tests in the U.S. and nobody had been preparing. And so it was very frustrating and upsetting. And the reality is the bureaucracy that government creates is a real problem. I talk a lot in there about our battles with HUD. I'm currently battling HUD right now on a property that they're refinancing for the fourth time. They've now decided that all of our refrigerators are 3 inches too deep. And so during the middle of the COVID pandemic, they want us to go in and tell every resident to take all their food out of their freezers and their refrigerators and risk potentially losing all that food so that we can give them smaller refrigerators and freezers. You tell me which resident is going to really appreciate the government regulation that's causing that and how that is making affordable housing more attainable. And why are they doing that? I mean, I'm assuming it's regulation 7963 little I B or whatever. That they're pointing to. And, that's where we get to with our bureaucracies. And so the private sector plays a tremendous role. John Houston runs the largest multifamily contracting firm in North Carolina, or has done the most over the last 40 years as a contractor. And his quote that he often says is, The most affordable housing I build is for-profit market rate housing. The least affordable housing I build is what they call capital A affordable housing. And the reality is the red tape that comes with the bureaucracy adds about $30,000 per unit to the cost of an apartment. And so if you're building a 200-unit apartment, you know, that's $6 million of regulation costs that you could avoid if you'd built that in the private sector.
So you had the coronavirus, and tell us about your experience with it. Did you require hospitalization, or were you able to lick this thing at home and just get some bed rest?
Well, the beauty was I was told I didn't have coronavirus because we didn't have any tests. So I didn't develop the natural symptoms. I had like what felt like a, you know, fever bug when you're a kid. You get these 24-hour fever bugs. Had one of those. It just lasted a whole lot longer than 24 hours. But once the fever broke, I went back into society and decided, hey, I just had a fever bug. And then I got a really bad cold and said, okay, my immune system's down. So I went back out of society with a bad cold. And then only 2 weeks later, literally I got the virus on March 4th. I went in March 6th to get tests and was told there were none available. By March 13th, my doctor said, hey, I have access to a test. I said, well, I want it. I went in and got it, even though at this point I was pretty much well. And then 5.5 days later, they call me on March 18th at 5:30 in the afternoon. I was actually out mountain biking, and I got a text that said, congratulations, you got the coronavirus. Call ASAP. And I'm like, I think you mean I had the coronavirus. And I think only then did I start having a cough, because I realized a cough came with coronavirus. So that just shows you the power of suggestion. And so I was very fortunate.
Fortunate. Congratulations
The people I came in contact with on the 4th all came down with the virus. They say it's most contagious the first 10 minutes you get symptoms, which is why the quarantine is so important. You can be shopping in the grocery store. I suddenly start to feel a little bit ill. By the time you get to the cashier, you're the most contagious you'll ever be. And so that's a big part of it. But I was very fortunate. No one else got sick. None of my family members got sick. None of my coworkers got sick. And so I feel, you know, a huge sigh of relief that happened. Yeah, and the three people that came in contact with me those first couple of hours, fortunately, they all recovered. And as far as I know, no one else sick as well.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, our guest has been coronavirus survivor Clay Grubb. He is CEO and chairman of Grubb Properties. He's also the author of the book, Creating the Urban Dream, Tackling the Affordable Housing Crisis with Compassion, published this year, 2020, by Forbes Books. It's available everywhere you would find, expect to find books, Barnes & Noble, Amazon, Powell's Books, and so on. Clay, congratulations on the book. I hope it sells very, very well, and thank you for taking the time to talk about this affordable housing crisis we're facing.
Mike, I thoroughly enjoyed our time together, and thank you for agreeing to interview me, and I look forward to hopefully seeing you back in Charlotte so I can take you for some barbecue up in Lexington.